Okay, good morning, everybody. I apologize for the few minutes late against official Torah in Motion policy. Okay, I want to welcome everybody. I guess the first session Sunday morning, and we'll get right to it. For those who were not here last night and have not had the pleasure of hearing, you know, Rabbi Broid before, the truth of the matter is Rabbi Broid came to the first program I ever organized. Before Torah in Motion existed, there was nothing justice in Jewish law. I did it when I was the first, Yonah rabbi, and we thought if we had 20 people, we'd be happy. And we had, 50, 60 people, and thank God we get, now hundreds of people to some of our programs. So I want to thank him really for getting us off the ground. Rabbi Broid is really a consummate Talmud Chacham. He's a professor of law at Emory University, a Dayan on the Beit Din of America, really one who established the Beit Din of America, a major posek in the, not just in the modern Orthodox world. We were talking over Shabbos. He mentioned many, many Haredi, of the rabbis. They consult with Rabbi Broid on shailas that, like, they have in Evan Ezra, Choshen Mishpat. So it's really a pleasure to have a first-rate Talmud Chacham, a tremendous scholar of law and an entertaining speaker. And without further ado, from Atlanta, Georgia, Rabbi Michael Broid.
The topic of conversion, which is what we're going to talk about today, can be approached from... I'm sorry?
What did we...
No problem. It's not a problem. I came prepared with two lectures, and when I got up this morning, Rabbi Kelman said conversion first and then warfare, and now it turns out it's the other way around. It's not a problem. When you talk about military action, what you have to think about on a structural level is where law comes from. What do I mean by that? There are three basic approaches in the secular world to military ethics. The first approach says that there's no such thing as military ethics, and that, you know what you do in wartime? What you need to do. What you need to do. And that war is the wholesale suspension of law. The second theory in the secular world is the different. The second theory says that war is simply self-defense writ grand, and that just like when somebody comes to attack me, I can kill them. So too, when somebody comes to attack us, we can kill them. But that war is no different than the rest of life through and through. The third theory of military ethics in the secular world is that military ethics is governed by law, but the content of the law is different than the content of the daily law that we have. From a halachic perspective, when you talk about military ethics, the thing that you have to decide is you have to start from the theory downward. And you have to figure out what's the theory that governs how Jewish law views war. And until you answer that theory question, you don't have any intellectual basis for resolving questions. And this theory question was, for a long time, not addressed, because we didn't live in a society where Jews controlled any sum and substance of government, so that contemplating military ethics was unimportant. But that changed with the reestablishment of the State of Israel, and all of a sudden, a whole series of group questions began to be important. War ethics became one of those topics, And a great deal of thought went into the question of how does the Jewish tradition view war? There are, in essence, in the Jewish tradition, five theories for thinking about war. There are five theories. And these five theories boil down to two approaches. But it's important to understand all five of the theories in some analytic way. The first theory, first put forward by Rav Shach as the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, is worth putting forward, but then discarded. Okay? Rav Shach writes that the role of the Jewish people is to be a sheep among the wolves, and we are not allowed to fight at all. Part of the construct of the destruction of the Second Temple was a commitment by the Jewish people to live in dispersion and not to form military communities, and that the rabbis, in essence, decreed after the Hadrianic persecutions that we don't fight. And he maintains, in essence, that the reestablishment of the State of Israel was mistaken. I don't know how else to put it. And what the Jews are supposed to do is live in dispersion continuously at the mercy of their neighbors. And his vision of the Jewish tradition is, even as he's living in Bnei Brak, a diaspora vision. And Rabbi Shach imagines, not imagines, but he maintains that in essence all organized military activity is prohibited. It's prohibited. And that there is no Jewish tradition of war because the rabbis prohibited it. This theory, which, by the way, you see articulated here and there in the Hasidic world, was never accepted as mainstream and never thought of as proper. But it's a theory. You have to put it out there. You have to understand it. You occasionally will encounter it. If Judaism had Quakers, this would be the Quaker theory of how the Jewish tradition should function. The exact opposite of that theory is Rav Shaul Yisraeli's theory. Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli was the chief military chaplain of the Israeli army for many years, the founder of a yeshiva in Israel, and a well-known halachic authority. He argues the same premise with a different result. He says there is no halacha of war. War entails the wholesale suspension of the Jewish tradition, and everything is permissible in wartime that's necessary to do to accomplish the war. Rav Shaul Yisraeli's basic argument goes as follows. He says, look, if you can kill people to win the war, it's not just that you can kill people, it's that killing is such a serious sin, and yet it is permitted. We see that everything is permissible in wartime when it's necessary to win the war. And that there are no limits within the Jewish tradition as to what can be done when it's necessary to win the war. Of course, Rabbi Yisraeli will limit this by saying you can't engage in activity that's gratuitous. Can't engage in activity that's not necessary to win the war, but these are our handouts, but when, we'll come to the back of the handouts in just a few minutes, but when you encounter a situation in which what you've got to do to win the war is something disgusting and nefarious, so disgusting and nefarious is permissible in wartime. He writes this in 1953 in response to what's called the incident at Kibbalah. Does anybody know what happened? In 1953, Kibbalah was a village in Jordan. Israel was being infiltrated by Jordanian soldiers, and the Israeli government decided to retaliate. It sends a young, charismatic army officer in to retaliate. Anybody know his name?
Sharon.
Absolutely. And he goes into a Jordanian village named Kibbalah. He rounds up all the men, women, and children, puts them in a building, and blows up the building. Men, women, children. And when pressed, Rav Shaul Yisraeli said, look, you have to show the Jordanians that you're prepared to go tit for tat. And that if they're coming into our community, stepping into kibbutzim, and killing men, women, and children, you know what you have to show?
Strength.
You have to show strength. And you have to show that if you kill our children, you know what we'll do? We'll kill your children. And that you shouldn't think that we're not prepared to be as disgusting and nefarious and unpleasant as you are. You have to stop what you're doing to get us to stop what we're doing. But if you're not going to stop what you're doing, we're not going to stop what we're doing, and we're going to, if you step into our hospitals and kill our children, we're going to step into your hospitals and kill your children. And Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli thinks the Jewish law permits that. In essence, he argues that war is the wholesale suspension of every aspect of Jewish law that's necessary to win the war. It's not just that killing is permissible. It's that everything, including killing, is permissible. And he doesn't have any difficulty going through a list of gruesome things that he thinks are permissible as a matter of Jewish law in order to triumph. And I'll give you a... Well, we'll come to the cases in just a few minutes. The third theory is the theory of Rabbi Shlomo Goren, who becomes the chief rabbi of Israel. Rabbi Goren says both Rav Shach and Rav Yisraeli are wrong. And the reason why they're wrong is because there's an indigenous Jewish law of war. Open up the Rambam, Tilkos, Malachim, Milcham, Mosheim, the law of kings and their wars, and derive from it their rules of war. And he and Rabbi Yehuda Gershuni together developed something called Mishpate Melucha, law of war, which is an exposition of the Rambam's code, grounded in the real world that we live in. And their basic argument is there are principles. And these principles need to be applied in our current times. And that it's true the reality has changed, but even though the reality has changed, the principles shouldn't change at all. Rabbi Goren gives three basic principles. His first principle is as follows. You can only kill combatants, and he derives this from a statement found in the Rambam, can only kill combatants, and the killing of non-combatants is only permissible when you don't intend to kill them. But you may never consciously, knowingly, willfully intend to kill non-combatants. That's his first rule. His second rule is that the enemy should always be given the opportunity to surrender. And he bases that also on a pasuk of the Torah and a codification of that pasuk found in the Mishnah Torah. And there are no battles to the death. Everybody's given the chance to surrender. And that you always have to say to the enemy, we don't want to fight you. All you need to do to avoid being killed is surrender. And this stands in contrast, by the way, with what was, for many years in Israel, standard military practice when it came to terrorists, which is what? They killed them. They didn't allow surrender, and they shot terrorists. And this is, I would say, widely known. This was widely known, which is Israel took the view that when it came to combating terrorists, that they wouldn't allow the terrorists to kill people, and then when they were surrounded, surrender. It was understood that there was no surrender from terrorists. And if a terrorist put down his gun, you shot him then. Which, by the way, caused the terrorists never to put down their guns. And, well, if you think about it, that also makes them sad. But Rabbi Gorin's view is that everybody's given the opportunity to surrender. Surrender is a fundamental component of the halacha of war. And the third thing that Rabbi Gorin maintains is that halacha requires a vigorous chain of command, and that there's a hierarchical responsibility upon people who are in the lower levels to obey orders, and that there's no spontaneous right to engage in any activity. War is a hierarchical command structure according to Jewish law. Now, Rabbi Gorin lays out these three basic principles, and then he applies them in many, many, many different situations. But it's important to understand that in Rabbi Gorin's view, what Ariel Sharon did, which is to consciously round up innocent people to kill them, to show that just like you can kill our civilians, we will kill your civilians, was an act of murder. Whereas according to Rabbi Yisraeli, the act of killing civilians on the other side is unpleasant, but not an act of murder, simply a necessary activity to undertake in very, very, very difficult situations and circumstances. The fourth view is the view taken by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in our time. Rabbi Feinstein maintains that war is essentially governed by secular law, and that his position is that this is sort of dina de malchusa dina, the obligation to obey the law of the land writ large, and that there's something called international law and the Geneva Convention, and that we fight wars according to secular law. And that all that you have to do to be a good soldier is to obey the rules of the game. The rules of the game aren't necessarily Jewish at all. They're just the rules of the game that we all agree to play by. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, a contemporary halachic authority, says a modified version of this. He thinks that not only is law governed by secular law, but there is no difference between a Jewish army and a Gentile army with Jewish soldiers. Everybody, Jew and Gentile alike, is governed by this secular international law. So when you pressed Rabbi Feinstein about the rules of war, Rabbi Feinstein responded by taking out his copy of the Geneva Convention. And said that the rules of war are governed by the Geneva Convention. These five theories, all in various forms, compete intellectually within the Jewish tradition, but in fact, when you stop to look, you see that they've been boiled down. Everybody thinks Rav Schacht is incorrect, and that we live in a universe in which we are not interested in being sheep, and we are not interested in disbanding the state of Israel or necessarily living powerless in the dispersion and in the diaspora. So what we have left standing really are three theories. We have Rabbi Yisraeli's theory that everything goes. We have Rabbi Gorin's theory that there are indigenous Jewish law principles. And we have Rabbi Feinstein's theory that everything is governed by international law. And we can further boil these three principles down to two. Because Rabbi Yisraeli maintains, in fact, that if Israel agrees to obey international law, then it has to obey international law, because once you agree to play a game by a certain set of rules, then you play it. And this, by the way, was always the position of the government of the State of Israel, with one huge footnote. And this huge footnote is worth pondering. The position of the government of the State of Israel distinguishes between its combatants. The government of Israel says, when we are in combat with enemies who themselves agree to obey the Geneva Convention, then we obey the Geneva Convention too. But when we are in combat with combatants who themselves don't agree to obey the Geneva Convention, then we don't feel bound to either. And this distinguishes, by the way, for those of you who read the newspaper, between, for example, Israel's conduct vis-a-vis Egypt in the Yom Kippur War and Israel's conduct vis-a-vis Hezbollah. Hezbollah doesn't obey the Geneva Convention. It's not a signatory, and it doesn't play the rules of the game of war by the established rules. And Israel doesn't play the game of war by the established rules with Hezbollah either. Israel's argument is that the Geneva Convention simply doesn't apply because the government of Lebanon and Hezbollah hasn't yet agreed to sign the Geneva Convention, and they're not going to be bound by the Geneva Convention. Israel isn't going to be bound by the Geneva Convention unless its enemies are also. This argument, by the way, harkens back to the argument of the United States government, which says that the Taliban aren't governed by the Geneva Convention either. How come? Because they don't abide by it. And that if you, I mean, this basic theory of international law says it's a game. And the game has rules, and that whatever the rules are, in order for the rules to be binding, you know what you have to do? Both sides have to agree to them. The rules can be whatever they are, but there's no point in having these rules if only one side obeys these rules. So these basic theories to this day still exist in halacha, and it's worth pondering cases. In the back of the handouts, I give five cases. And we'll just go through them to understand the problems. I want to start with case five, because case five lays out for you the hardest and most complex case. During World War II, when the French forces in the interior continued to fight German occupation forces in France, Germany refused to treat members of the French resistance as combatants. Even though they wore insignia, carried their arms openly, and were in touch with both the Allies and the French provisional government in Algeria, and subject them to summary execution despite formal protests by the provisional government. Let's put this in plain English. France surrendered. De Gaulle takes the free French forces to England, and he continues to run a French government in exile from London and then from Algeria. Now, the Germans maintain that France surrendered. So any French soldiers who are fighting against the Germans, what are they? They're not soldiers. How come? Because France surrendered. Thus, French soldiers who were caught, the Germans maintained, were mere criminals. And as mere criminals, were subject to execution. As opposed to, by the way, British and American soldiers who, in general, were treated according to the Geneva Convention. There were almost no executions of American and British soldiers. And even though there was fear that Jewish soldiers would be mistreated, this gives rise to the famous dog tags called Protestant B. In World War II, the United States government, they used to mark your face on your dog tag. I think they still do. But in World War II, they used to mark the Jews with the legend of Protestant B rather than Jews, because people were afraid that Jewish soldiers would be mistreated by the Germans. So you could get a dog tag which said Catholic, you got a C, or you could get a dog tag which said Protestant, which was P, or you could get a dog tag which said PB, which stood for Protestant B, which everybody understood was Jewish. There were no Protestant Bs. But they didn't want to let the Germans segregate out the Jewish and the non-Jewish soldiers. But it turns out that the Germans meticulously obeyed the Geneva Convention when it came to American and British soldiers, and even Jewish prisoners of war were not mistreated. They were treated no differently than any other prisoners of war. I have a great uncle who attended Rosh Hashanah services in an American prisoner of war camp in Germany in 1944. So much so that the Jewish soldiers, the German prisoners of war camp, it was understood the Germans weren't going to mistreat American soldiers because there were so many German soldiers who were prisoners of war in the United States that if they started mistreating American soldiers, there'd be retaliation. But the free French soldiers, they just captured and killed. And they argued that since France had surrendered, there should be no free French soldiers. Because if you were a free French soldier, your loyalties should be to France. France had surrendered, thus you're just a criminal. So they used to line them up and kill them. Now, the free French soldiers really, really, really didn't like this. This was very bad for their morale. They found this to be extraordinarily unpleasant. So de Gaulle turns to the British and says, we don't want to go into France anymore to fight because when we get captured, we get killed. Let us guard German prisoners who are in Britain. And the British say, okay. And then de Gaulle starts taking German prisoners and he gets on the airways and he says as follows. The Free French Forces of the Interior threatened reprisals, and when the executions didn't stop, they shot 80 German prisoners under their control. They just lined up German prisoners against the barn wall in England and shot them dead. And the story is told that he took these German prisoners, their bodies, put them on an airplane, and dropped them over Germany with notes saying, these are reprisal killings for the killing of French soldiers. If you stop killing our soldiers, we'll stop killing yours. And the Germans said, nope. So he did it again. And this went on for a few days, where the Free French were flying planes over Germany, dropping bodies of dead German prisoners of war out of airplanes. And after a week of doing this, Germany announces a change of policy, which is, from now on, free French forces will be treated consistent with the Geneva Convention. And all that de Gaulle had to do to get this change of policy was murder. 80, 90, 100, by some accounts, 250 German prisoners to get the Germans to change their policy. Permissible? I'm sorry?
It saved lives.
Boy, did it save lives. If you ask de Gaulle why was it okay, de Gaulle said it saved lives. It saved lives. The killing of these German prisoners prevented the killing of countless French soldiers who would otherwise be summarily murdered. What's the counter argument? These people were captive. They were totally and completely without any blame. They weren't killed in combat. Thank you so much. They had surrendered. And when you line surrendered soldiers up against the wall and shoot them, that's just murder. That's just murder. Somebody want to explain to me? So this case is one of the fulcrum cases to decide whose theory is right. Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, look, war is extraordinarily unpleasant and very, very, very unhappy. Nobody really has any rights at all. And if you have to kill 250 German prisoners in order to save the lives of French soldiers, you do it. You don't have to smile about it, but you do it. And the reason why you do it is because, at the end of the day, nobody really has any right to live or die in wartime, and you do what you have to do in order to reduce your own casualties and increase the casualties of the enemy. This was necessary to prevent the killing of German, of French soldiers, it wasn't gratuitous, it was necessary, and thus it was permissible. Both Rabbi Feinstein's view and Rabbi Gorin's view says that this is a core violation. The reason why it's a core violation is Rabbi Feinstein would say it was a violation of the Geneva Convention, and Rabbi Gorin would say it was an indigenous violation of Jewish law, which is you're just not allowed to kill innocent people. End of conversation.
The difference that, according to Rabbi Gorin, that they were soldiers as opposed to innocent people?
I don't think so. I think Rabbi Gorin would say once a soldier has surrendered, he's not a combatant anymore. That's why I didn't use the distinction soldier versus civilian. I used the distinction combatant versus non-combatant. I don't think Jewish law looks deeply at whether you're wearing a uniform or not. I think it looks at whether you're a combatant. If I have a law school class, you know, I graduated from NYU Law School 20 years ago, and we run a law school bulletin, and people talk about what they're doing. I'm also a graduate of YU of Reeds, and it's always interesting to watch the contrast between what alumni say in these two organizations, because in the rabbinic alumni, everybody underplays whatever they've accomplished. That's the way it goes among rabbinic alumni. Nobody brags. Everybody understates whatever they've done. In law school, everybody overstates. So I have a law school classmate who says, and I have no reason to doubt him, that he no longer works in law. He pilots drones for the CIA over Afghanistan from the Pentagon, and he comes in every day to the Pentagon to kill people in Afghanistan. That's what he writes in his law school notes. He's a combatant if he's telling the truth. But it doesn't matter if he goes to work every day in jeans and T-shirts, and it doesn't matter that he never has entered Afghanistan. He's a combatant. The line between civilian and combatant, which was very firm, let's say 150 years ago, has merged because the technology of war allows people who don't seem to be in combat to actually be in combat. This is very much in contrast with the historical norms. Let's take the greatest battle in North America, which is the Battle of Gettysburg. In the Battle of Gettysburg, about 200,000 soldiers do battle in a 5-mile by 5-mile area. There are 50,000 casualties in the Battle of Gettysburg over 3 days. One in every 4 soldiers is killed, wounded, or missing. How many civilians are killed in the Battle of Gettysburg? One woman is killed in a free ricochet shot. A bullet is shot at one area, it bounces off a tree, it hits a roof, it bounces off the roof, and it enters into this innocent woman's home where by a freak accident it kills her. The battle stops for the 15 minutes it takes to care for this woman because everybody knows something terrible and immoral has taken place, which is an innocent person was killed. What about the 50,000 people who are killed or wounded on the battlefield? That's just life. That model, though, in which battles have very firm battlefields, sort of like football or hockey or baseball, and either you're on the field, in which case you're a combatant, or you're off the field, in which case you're not, no longer makes any sense. There's no battlefield. Combatants frequently are far away from the battlefield, and civilians are frequently on the battlefield. So the historical model, which allows you to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants by the field of battle, no longer really resonates as true, because the field of battle is very big, and intermixed in the field of battle are combatants and civilians, all of whom are going about doing their own thing. Whereas until, give or take, World War I, the battlefield was demarcated in advance. And you were told, we're here, we're going to fight a very big battle. You know what you should do? If you don't want to be a soldier in the battle, you know what you should do? Leave. This is not a good place to be to play touch football. we're going to fight a battle here. And by the way, in Gettysburg, that's what the Union and the Confederate does. They say, we're fighting a battle here tomorrow. Leave. And everybody who wasn't a combatant left. And this is true for medieval battles as well. There'd be a clash of armies in a very small area. Because look, even in the middle of the Civil War, no weapon an army carried went more than 2,000 yards. A cannon, the best cannon would go 2,000 yards. The typical soldier's musket went 200 yards. So there was a field of battle. If you were out of the field of battle, you were a civilian. But we no longer have a notion of a battlefield in any conventional sense of the way. We launch missiles from here and there. You can be sitting in your office in Washington piloting drones over Afghanistan, and you're a combatant. For sure you're a combatant. And you can be sitting in your civilian area in the middle of a battlefield, and you're really not a combatant. By World War II, that clearly was the case, because once you start introducing bombers into a battlefield, so you have a very ill-defined notion of the battlefield. So in fact, the notion of a battlefield functionally disappears. Case four. Consider the often discussed problem in the Vietnam War of convincing captured Vietnamese officers to share information with American intelligence. This was a difficult task for many reasons. The Vietnamese were culturally foreign. Many American officers didn't speak the language. They were hard-pressed to distinguish truthful from false information. But they developed this very effective technique. But the American officers found the single most effective way to get captives to share information was to take five prisoners up in a helicopter and ask one of them a question. If he refused to answer without any further discussion, he was pushed out of the helicopter. And the next prisoner was questioned. This method seemed to work. Now, what does that mean? It didn't work on the first guy. Okay? Didn't work on the first guy. What happened? It worked on the second guy. Okay? It worked on the second guy. This method of getting people to talk didn't cause the first guy to share any information with you, but it had a wonderful effect on the second guy. So what do you think? What do you think? You read this and you say, gosh, this is really, really, really unpleasant. But this was a pretty standard technique. Meaning dozens and dozens and dozens of people were pushed off helicopters in this way. Because they found that this really, really, really inspired the people who weren't pushed off the helicopter to talk. Okay, that's what it did. It didn't inspire the people who were pushed off the helicopter to talk, but it inspired everybody else. When you were brought up in the helicopter, and the guy ahead of you was asked a question, and he said, I'm not talking to you, and they just push him off the helicopter. And then they say, now it's your turn. So you really understood that if you didn't talk, you were pushed off the helicopter too. It brought home this very concrete, unpleasant activity. Help. Somebody want to tell me? Nope. It's easier. I'll tell you why. This case is much easier. Because the people who are being killed have it in their own hands to avoid being killed by sharing information. This is different than the German prisoners who were killed in the previous case, because they really had nothing they could say. Meaning when... So I think that here you have a little bit more play in the following sense. If you're an acceptor of Dina Demaklusidina, of international law, so then you say this conduct is prohibited because prisoners don't have to answer questions. But Roshal Yisraeli and Rabbi Gorin might say the following view. Given the fact that this person has information, and he chooses not to share this information, maybe he reverts to the status of a combatant because his decision to be silent is in essence a continuation of the warfare. That's different than my German prisoner who I'm just going to line up against the brick wall and shoot. When he says, what can I do to prevent this? You know what we say to him? Nothing. We're just going to kill you because killing you teaches a lesson over there. Whereas in this case...
What happens if the person doesn't have information? He doesn't believe.
So, okay, but that's to some extent unintended. Presumably he'll tell us everything he can and we'll realize he's shared with us everything. And then we can't kill him because if we kill him then, everybody will realize no matter whether you share or don't share, they kill you. Meaning that's an incentive-based conversation through and through. But this case is a little bit easier. This case is a little bit easier because what you have here are pseudo-combatants. People who have information that you need, who are consciously choosing not to share that information with you. And you feel that that information is necessary. This case is a little less unpleasant than the fifth case.
How does case number five differ from wholesale bombing? You know, talking about civilian bombing, like the bombing of Nancy.
Right.
What is the difference between that? Because it's effectively, again, purposely killing civilians.
Right.
In order to achieve deterrence or to achieve some other...
So I think that wholesale bombing of civilian populations is even harder to justify because there's no specific deterrence. Case number five might be easier than wholesale bombing because De Gaulle said as follows, look, I have a specific policy of yours that you need to change. I'm not just randomly killing German prisoners, stop. I'm telling you, you have a policy that's killing French prisoners, I'm going to have a policy that's killing German prisoners, you stop killing my prisoners, I'll stop killing your prisoners. Maybe we'll touch on wholesale civilian bombing before we finish. Somebody else had a hand up.
Ignoring Muhammad for a moment, what role does that enter into this discussion?
So far, I don't think so, because none of these people are threatening me. Neither in case number five, nor in case number four. Am I killing somebody who poses any sort of a threat to me?
But the expanded concept of Rodic involves saving lives as well.
But Rodic requires a determination that the person who I'm killing is in fact the person who's trying to kill me. Let me give you just an example. Somebody comes to me and says, I'm going to kill your kids. So I can't kill his kids. I can kill him, but I can't kill his kids. Because Rodic requires that I kill the guilty. It doesn't require that I kill a person who's not threatening me in any way, shape, or form.
Are these in control of information?
That would be a vast expansion of Rodin. That would be a significant expansion. Case number three. Let us consider a yet more troubling case. And this is, by the way, also a real case. A very deeply troubling case. Mustafa Dirani, who was until recently held hostage by Israel, and he had information about and perhaps access to the location of a missing Israeli soldier named Ron Aran, filed suit in the Tel Aviv District Court alleging he was sodomized by a member of the Shin Bet named George as a form of interrogation. Although I presume that this allegation is false, would such conduct be permissible according to Jewish law, assuming that it would be effective in extracting information needed to save a soldier the government is seeking to rescue, and assuming he is ordered by the army through a duly authorized military order following the chain of command? Let me talk to you about the real world here, so you should be very unhappy. The Israelis have said many times in many very private settings that the Arab prisoners are very tough nuts to crack and that they don't respond under physical interrogation and they don't really respond to being killed. And that even when one of them is killed, they remain stoic and uncooperative and that they're just very tough people. And that they don't respond to being tortured. I would tell you just about anything in response to being tortured. The Arabs seem to be very tough people. And the Israelis discovered something really, really, really unpleasant. Sodomy worked. And it loosened lips. And it made people talk because it was a deep cultural violation, much worse than being killed or beaten. So what do you think of that? And by the way, there are 7 lawsuits filed in Israel against this pseudonymous George from the Shin Bet. And the word out there is that the Israelis do this with some frequency, and it's very effective. And that people who are happy to die as Arabs and don't talk after you beat the living daylights out of them, talk rather than be sodomized. You know, this is a very unpleasant business. I spent about 18 months, about 4 years ago, working as an ethics advisor to the Navy. And I used to talk once a week with a group of colonels who were in Iraq. I was in Atlanta, but they were in Iraq going through dilemmas. These kinds of dilemmas about life in Iraq. I first of all will tell you that I found the colonels that I dealt with to be extraordinarily sensitive, ethical, good, proper people. I was extraordinarily impressed with the caliber of the officers in the United States Marine Corps. I dealt almost exclusively with Marines. They were very high caliber, ethical people. Really, really, really impressive people. But the ethical dilemmas that they encountered were horrible. Horrible, horrible, horrible dilemmas, where they had to balance saving lives of their own soldiers with doing really bad things. So here we have a really bad thing to do. Let's assume it's effective. Let's assume that if we sodomize Mustafa Durrani, he'd tell us what we need to know. And by the way, when you read like what the Israelis say informally off the record, they say they returned Mustafa Durrani back home because they got all the information from him they needed. And he was of no use anymore, so they gave him back. Anybody want to help me? Please.
Can you distinguish between Arab and Muslim? Or?
No, I don't think so. I think that in the right situation, you could do this to an Arab who's an enemy. If perchance he's a Jew, you could do it to a Jew as well. I don't think this is a distinction based on your faith. I think this is a distinction based on the threat you pose.
Does Jewish law have anything to say about that?
That's the question. So the Torah tells us that there are three activities that you're not allowed to do even to save your life. They are avodah zarah, gilui arayot, improper sexual activity, and murder. So homosexuality is one of these prohibited activities, but so is murder. If I told you killing Mustafa Durrani returned Ron and Rod, I kill him. And I think Jewish law would permit that.
This is the same one.
This is the reverse, of course. Of course, but Ron Arad is an Israeli soldier. Presumably, if to return an Israeli soldier from captivity, you have to kill one of the enemy. Jewish law would permit that. If I told you we could pilot into Lebanon to rescue Ron Arad, in the course of piloting into Lebanon, we'd have to kill 2 Arabs who are guarding him, to rescue him, you say, well, of course that's permissible. Of course that's permissible. So if killing Mustafa Durrani caused the return of Ron Arad, that would be permissible. I don't have a question with that. What about sodomizing him causing this return?
Well, what about suicides during the Middle Ages by Jews?
So, and I think that's a different case through and through, in the sense that it wasn't in wartime in the classical sense that you imagine it. I can explain what's going on there, but it's a different conversation. Suicide might be harder to justify halakhically than homicide in the right situation. Anybody want to help me? Nice pleasant topic. Go back home when people ask you, what did you talk about today? You say sodomy. Please.
I mean, since all of these depend to a great extent on the likelihood that the desired outcome is actually going to occur if you
let's assume for the purposes of this conversation that the best guess is that this is highly likely.
So then it would make sense in general it would be permissible, but the reality is that there's a very significant difference between flying over Lebanon and you know where Ramadan is, you have to kill a whole 100 people to get there because there's some sort of certainty. Whereas in the case of Sabah, if you get information, even if you get the information, which is unlikely, and that information would have to be useful, that information would have to lead to something. So there's a whole series of svekas there that are a barrier that aren't a barrier.
So let me lay out in fact for you the Landau Commission's observation. The Landau Commission was a commission of the Israeli Supreme Court. What time do they end, if I kill them?
10:15 is the next session. So
I'm sorry?
Approximately 10:10.
Okay. The Landau Commission said the only way you can use these kinds of techniques is if you use them all the time on lots of people and you collect many different sources of information so you can cross correlate information. So the unpleasant answer that you'll get is you have to torture lots and lots and lots of people to get any valuable information and to deter people from lying. Because when you torture somebody, and they want to make the torture stop, what do they tell you?
Anything.
No. They start by telling you a falsehood. A falsehood. Of course. A falsehood that could be true, but which in fact isn't. To prevent them from doing this, you have to, you ready for this really unpleasantness? You have to torture lots of people, and when you catch somebody saying a verifiable falsehood, you know what you have to do? Torture him gratuitously so that he should learn not to lie to you. We're in a very unpleasant business. We're in a very, very unpleasant business. But that's just the reality, because of course people tell you false information when you torture them all the time, because they don't want to give you true information, but they don't want to be tortured. So you have to make the ground rules clear, which is, if you give us false information, we're going to come back and torture you gratuitously, just to remind you not to give us false information. And word gets out among the prisoners that that's exactly what happens, because the prisoners communicate all the time. It's a downright unpleasant business. Look, you know, I'll just share with you a story I heard from a colonel in the course of my duty, which is an American soldier went out one night for a drink, and he didn't come back. And, the colonel, who's in charge, is freaking out. And they organize search parties, but they can't find him. So they organize, a wholesale gathering of everybody in the village. And the colonel, in essence, says, here's the way it goes, buddies. I've got a missing soldier. I need him back. And I need him back in the next 5 hours. And if he doesn't come back in the next 5 hours, lots and lots and lots of people are going to be killed. Because he's got to do that. Because the only way he can get him back is by persuading the villagers, who either know where he is or who happened, that the price of keeping him is way too high. It's just way too high.
Isn't that like Nazi, like Nazis done? Like they gather up the villagers, if one Nazi soldier was killed, just to teach the lessons from the others?
Sure. Collective punishment is the only way you can manage a civilian population. That's what Ariel Sharon did in Jordan. The Kibbalah incident is the tit for tat that it takes to persuade people not to mess with you. Boy, is collective punishment unhappy. But if you don't engage in collective reward and collective punishment, you don't have it in you to be an occupier. Because without it, you have no real possibility of occupying a wholesale civilian population. I don't know. An Israeli soldier has been kidnapped, case number 2, and then we'll... Military steps include the following. Most Israeli soldiers were kidnapped during the Intifada, as opposed to Israel's prior wars, are killed by the captors, often hideously. The soldiers being held in a fortified booby trap location by captors were ordered to shoot him if rescues appear. In all likelihood, Any rescue attempt will result in the death of the captured soldier, or at least one other Israeli soldier. Maybe the army undertake a rescue mission in this case. Do you understand that this is what happened to Nachshon Waxman? They weren't attempting to rescue him. They knew they couldn't rescue him. Meaning, they wanted to rescue him, they wished to rescue him, they prayed to rescue him, but they didn't have a plan to rescue him. They had a plan to storm where he was and force a confrontation, which would produce, most likely, his death. And this was because the Israeli government came to the conclusion that kidnapped soldiers produce much worse consequences than dead soldiers. By the way, this is the policy of the United States government in Iraq. We've been in Iraq for how many years? 5. How many American prisoners of war are there in Iraq? None. 0. Want to know why? When American soldiers are taken prisoner, the government marshals troops, put so much pressure on the people who are holding them, you know what they do? They kill them and run. Because we won't allow American soldiers to be taken prisoner in Iraq because it's too difficult for the public to accept. Deaths, the public can accept. Prisoners, the public won't accept. Israel, by the way, has learned that Israeli soldiers being taken prisoner is very hard for the public. Dead Israeli soldiers, it's very sad, but the public accepts it as a price. So Nachshon Waxman was held hostage in a house. The Israelis didn't have a plan to rescue him. They hoped they would rescue him. We all hope for things. But there wasn't a plan to rescue him because rescuing him was impossible. Because he was surrounded by people who were under instructions to kill him the moment the rescue plan started. And that's what happened. So it turns out that not only is it very difficult to sometimes contemplate killing the other side, but sometimes you have to contemplate killing your own. Sometimes you have to contemplate killing your own. And that's just the sad reality out there. It really, really, really is bad. I say this to you because understanding the complexities of the problem of military ethics from a Jewish perspective requires really understanding both what you have to do and the leeway halakha permits you to do it. It doesn't produce happy answers. Most cases resolve themselves in the best of circumstances, with bad people being terribly punished far more than they deserve. Some cases produce an even worse result, which is good people get punished worse than they deserve. You have to ask yourself, maybe Nachshon Waxman would be better served if we had never rescued him. He'd still be living in that house as a captive. But we wouldn't be better served by that. So we are going to try to rescue him. The price that was paid for the rescue attempt was paid by him. On the other hand, the Israeli government argued that it sent the message out to people who would kidnap Israeli soldiers. Two messages, very important messages. The first is, we'll kill you if you do this. We will kill you. And the second message is, we won't negotiate with you even if it produces the death of our own soldiers. Because that's the only way we can deter this kind of conduct. It's a very hard, unpleasant message. Do I have time for questions or not?
Of course, we're going to have.
Okay.
In relation to what happened this summer, with the
right? So releasing prisoners is a very complicated conversation. Prisoners are exactly pawns in this conversation. Israel made the decision to release prisoners to get back bodies. I don't agree or disagree with it. I think it's a very hard calculus. If they could have rescued them, they would have rescued them. If they knew where they were, they would have tried to rescue them, even if it meant killing them. That's a very difficult situation.
You know, okay, last question.
Last question.
I'm sorry. Ladies first, ladies first.
Sure, the gratuitous. The gratuitous is prohibited. So Abu Ghraib is prohibited because all that was happening in Abu Ghraib was that a lieutenant had a bad day and a girlfriend. And to impress the girlfriend and release the stress of the bad day, he would torture people for entertainment, sort of like being a day school teacher. I didn't mean that.
I think on that note we can end, right?
That's I didn't mean that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But I used to have a Rebbe who used to say I had a really rough day at home. So today you're going to have a really hard time.
On that note, we'll take a 4-minute break. In this room, Dr. Tamar Ross. Rabbi Broid will be giving his second shiur on conversion in the Sisterhood Hall, and Rabbi Lau be'ivrit in room 29. And we'll reconvene in 4 minutes.